All right, so last week we talked about the Tanakh, right, which is the Hebrew Old Testament, and we call it the Old Testament. We talked about how it's structured very theologically, and how Judges really needs to be read before we move into Samuel, 1st and 2nd Samuel, because Judges, remember, it has this, you have like all the whole scenarios are playing out. You got this abomination, what's happening in Benjamin, Judah's coming into war, the civil war happening, and then the last verse of Judges says, and there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And so you just have this kind of, you're left with this, what is Israel going to do, right? Nothing is good. It's a disaster. What are they going to do? And then you pick up with Samuel, according to the Hebrew version of the Old Testament, and you're instantly introduced to these characters of mercy and God's favor and God's remembrance, right? You have Elkanah and Hannah, and then, of course, in Samuel, they are very much contrasted with Eli and Hophni and Phinehas. You get these kind of two different trios set out before us. We saw Hannah come in and pray, ask for the Lord's provision. And then we saw she was given the second of the three Nazarites for life that we find in the Bible. You have Samson as the first Nazarite for life, Samuel, and then who was the third?
John the Baptist.
Yeah, John the Baptist, Nazarite for life. Yep. So you get those three Nazarites for life. So he's the second. At the age of 4, Hannah gives Samuel to Eli at the temple. Which at this point was probably more of this like semi-permanent tabernacle structure at Shiloh. And so tonight, we're going to pick up, chapter 1 ends with them worshiping the Lord and then getting ready to go home, right? That's kind of how it ends there. So we're going to pick up, though, with what's called Hannah's Prayer in Samuel 2. And we're going to look at in chapter 2, you have this contrast. You have Hannah's victory and Eli's downfall. So Hannah's got this song of triumph, and then you're going to get this back and forth between Eli's wickedness, Samuel's holiness, Eli's wickedness, Samuel's holiness, judgment on Eli, and then we come into Samuel. And so you're going to see these families just contrasted against each other the whole time we go through the text. So what I want to do is I want to read all of Hannah's song together, and then we're going to come back to a few pieces of it and talk about it and break them down. So poems were meant to be sung in their entirety, right? They're meant to be as a whole piece. And I actually was talking, I don't remember who I was talking to, maybe Bill Rothser about this, I don't remember. But I was reading one guy, and he made the point that maybe when we spend 6 months preaching through Galatians, we've misunderstood the point of a letter. Like, the letter is meant to be read at one time to the people in one sitting so you can see all the themes and all the things. Not that you can't slow down and go through, but sometimes we can overpick and we can miss kind of the forest for the trees in that sense, right? And so we're going to read the whole thing. I'm going to go back and highlight a couple things in there that I think will be helpful. But before we read it, let me kind of set it up. So songs in Old Testament narrative, when we come to a song, the purpose of the song is theological summary of events, right? It's theological. Like, it is a way for the people of Israel to encapsulate everything happening in a way that they can remember. So after the Exodus, what's the first thing that we have? If they cross through the sea, what's the first thing that happens? Moses sings a song, right? The Song of Moses. And then you have Miriam has a song right after that. At the end of Deuteronomy, he's given the covenant, he's given the law, they're getting ready to enter the promised land. What happens? He has a song, and he composes all the things the Lord is doing for his people. Another song of Moses. After Deborah and Barak defeat the enemies, what do we have? Song of Deborah and Barak, right? You see these significant events. So songs are really the easiest way for us to, for the people back then to encapsulate what God is doing in a memorable way. We'll have Hannah's song. David's going to sing a song after Yahweh delivers him. He's also going to sing a song at his death, reflecting on God's hand throughout his life. So songs are really important. They're telling you that some significant summary of redemptive historical arc is kind of happening right there. And look, no one goes home on Sunday afternoon and hums my sermons. I don't think. That's it. I don't think that's what's happening. But I bet a lot of you have gone home and hum the songs that we've sing at the service. Certain things, songs have a way of sticking in your head. And so one of the easiest ways to put theology into our brains is by singing them. And so our the songs that we sing matter. The theology matters. If the theology is wrong, we have problems. And so that stuff matters. So Hannah has the honor of kind of codifying the theology of her recent past, of God's miraculous action, and also kind of looking forward, kind of writing the song that generations of Israelites would grow up singing. And she's in great company. She's in company with Moses, Miriam, Deborah, Barak, King David. It's great company. Of course, who is, gets the New Testament, where's the famous song there? Mary, right? Yeah. So good company, right? All the way across. Mary's Magnificat, right? And what I handed out to you is most scholars believe that Mary's Magnificat is structured and draws heavily on Hannah's song. As you look through, the themes are very similar. They kind of begin and end the same way. The justice, all this kind of stuff. So we're going to read Hannah's song, and then we're going to kind of look at some things in these two. I'll kind of make the case there, and then we'll move through. So let's sing. Let's sing. 1 Samuel 2, I'm not going to make y'all sing it, 1 through 10. And Hannah, and you don't want me to sing it. And Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exalts in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. But the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne seven, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit the seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones. But the wicked shall be cut off in darkness, for not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed one." All right, so one of the things that most scholars agree upon, like I said, is that Mary heavily draws from Hannah's song. And so if you look at the handout, they're not mirror images, but they share themes in common more than any other two songs do in the Old Testament and New Testament. So both celebrate God's greatness and holiness. So 1 Samuel 2:2 and Luke 1, I didn't put the numbers there, I'm sorry, Luke 1:49. Both see a reversal of fortunes, 2:4 and 1:52. Both see God's provision for the needy, 2:5 and 1:53. Both see God's faithfulness, 2:10 and 1:55. But they all, so there's these common things, they also share this common flow of thought. Both begin with the personal praise of God, transition to his actions for his people with an emphasis on justice, mercy, and power. Both end with praising his faithfulness, right? So it's just general flow that's happening. Both women give birth to miraculous children, right? A miraculous child. Both children are, it's interesting, both are house of the Lord's servants. So we don't actually get that with any other barren birth. They don't go and serve in the house of the Lord. Samuel serves in the house of the Lord. Of course, Jesus is the sacrifice. He is the, right? He is the ultimate, all of that put together, right? So they're the only priests, if you would, that come out of those barrenness people. So significant connections there. Let's walk through just a few of these verses. Look back at verse 1. "And Hannah prayed and said, 'My heart exalts the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies, because I rejoice in your salvation.'" All right, so what's she celebrating here? Answer to a prayer. That's right. Yeah, Samuel, right? I mean, she's celebrating the birth. This is what she asked for. Celebrating her barrenness. You remember how Penaniah would ridicule her and mock her, right? The imagery here of the horn being exalted. The Lord speaks this kind of this idea that the animals would raise their horns high, like in victory and intimidation and that kind of thing. So her head is thrown up, the horns are up high, sign of victory and power. That's why you guys don't like the horns down. Right? Okay. There we go. We get it, right? Okay. Horns also symbolize strength, right? In Revelation, the lamb has how many horns? Seven horns, right? The seven horns meant to symbolize the ultimate amount of strength, the ideal number of strength and authority. And Hannah's strength, her horn, is exalted. And she's been seated back in her power, it's kind of, which for a woman in that day would have been to be someone who bears children. And that's what that would have been. The value found a woman was her ability to bear children for her husband, right? And again, we talked a lot about barrenness. It's not simply being able to bear children. That, of course, culturally was a huge part of the whole thing. But it also goes back to what they understood as the promise, right? Because what's the promise? That there's going to be a seed. And if you can't bear a child, what can you not potentially contribute to? The seed, the redemption, right? So you're kind of out of the redemptive plan is kind of how it would feel. So it's much bigger than just simply cultural. It's also very much religious aspect of feeling like you're not contributing potentially to this long-awaited promised seed that would come and redeem the people. This is a big deal. And I think it's worth pointing out, Hannah doesn't say, my horn is exalted because I have borne a child. Right? She says, my horn is exalted in Yahweh. Right? So the shift is, she shifts the attention from her to Yahweh. You would say she doesn't celebrate the gift. She celebrates the gift giver. Right? And that is a shift. That's an important shift in attention. It's a nuance that we could probably, in general, in life, do better with. Right? And we very often, you think of the 10 lepers. Right? 10 of them healed. How many come back? One. Right? They all want the gift, and they celebrate the gift, but they haven't come back to celebrate the gift giver. Right? So that's something we probably as a culture in general are pretty bad about. We definitely celebrate the gift, but we're not great about thanking the gift giver. So it's his salvation, she says, that he rejoices in, and it comes the manner of her son, but she's looking at Yahweh and going, it's the gift giver. Like, this is what I rejoice in. This is what exalts in. This is where my strength is found. This is what raises my horn up, right? This is all of these things. And it's interesting, the next verse there, I love that. My mouth derides my enemies, that next line there. The English doesn't help us a whole lot with this. The Hebrew meaning carries more of the understanding of my mouth, like, bolts down my enemies. So the idea is that a victorious beast would hold its horns high, and its teeth, aggressiveness, would intimidate the other animals around it, right? Like there's a great Dwight Schrute line from The Office where he says, I never smile if I can help it. And primates, showing one's teeth is a sign of weakness, you know? And so his argument is like, so I don't ever show my teeth for a sign of weakness. But when you think of lions roaring, you think of like these big beasts of the sea, when the teeth are shown, it's an intimidation factor. When I try to trim my dog's toenails, I get the teeth, right? Like, hey, back up, right? Like it's, we understand this side of things. And so what she's actually saying is, my horn's exalted, my head is lifted up, right? And then my mouth, like, I intimidate that my enemies cower. You see, and now who would have been Hannah's enemy? Do you remember? It was that other wife, right? The one who would mock her and scorn her and all this kind of stuff, and now she's been validated, right? Her prayer's been answered. She's been validated. She has a son, and it is her honor to give him to the service of the Lord. So it's really, really a lot going on there, which is neat. Any questions on, I'm not going to go verse by verse through all of them, but that verse one was important to touch. All right, let's keep going. Verse 2. Put this up here. Verse 2. She picks up on, again, the theme of God being a rock. So Moses picks up on this, or starts with this. She picks up on it. David's going to continue with it. Daniel's vision has, you remember, he has a vision of the rock coming in and shattering the statue of the nations, right? We see Christ as the cornerstone, the rock upon which the rest of the temple stands, right, or falls. So you have this imagery of the rock coming in. Verses 3 through 9. Or that reversal of fortunes we talked about between that are shared with Mary and Hannah's songs. It's a focus on justice, focus on mercy. Verse 10 is an assurance and praise for Yahweh and his king. Now, is there a king yet? Not a king yet, right? So there's not a king yet, yet she is praising Yahweh's anointed king. So there's something prophetic happening here as well, right? Hannah is giving us something prophetic going on. The king's not even in view. It's not just theological history, but it's also prophetic, which we get some of that in Elizabeth's song as well. Look at Elizabeth's Luke 1, 41 through 45. And when Elizabeth, you know, mother of John the Baptist, heard the greeting of Mary, the baby leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit, and she exclaimed with a loud cry, "Blessed are you among women, blessed is the fruit of your womb. And why is this granted to me that the mother of my Lord should come to me? For behold, when the sound of your foot of your greeting came to my ears, the baby in my womb leaped for joy. Blessed is he who believes that there will be a fulfillment of what was spoken to her from the Lord." Most scholars classify this as prophetic. It's a prophetic song. And again, it points to the king. It points to the king that's coming, right? The ultimate king that's coming. The one that all the other kings all pointed to as well. And so when you have this really out of the mouth of the last prophet before the king comes, you have a prediction of the king. And then out of the mouth of the last prophet before the final king comes, you have a prophecy about the king, right? So you can see these are really anchors that are meant to kind of reflect on each other as they go. And I think pointing out these commonalities is not pointing out like neat coincidences. When God is doing these things in the New Testament, the Jews would have said, "I've heard this story before. Like I know this story." Right? And it shows that he is fulfilling to a greater level all the things that have come before, right? So it's the Jews are hearing, and these are familiar stories, familiar routines, familiar cycles. And so it's really intentional on God's part. It's funny, you get the more liberal side of the camp, and they just go, "Well, yeah, I love the argument," like the theological liberal side of the camp. They'll say things like, "Well, a lot of those passages in the Old Testament, they contradict, and the scribes just couldn't figure it out." But this other side of the coin for them is, now these guys in the New Testament, they just copied everything in the Old Testament, made it work. They're like, okay, so these guys could figure out how to use all this stuff in this intricate way, but they couldn't see that the story looked the same here and here. It really is an inconsistent argument for how we look at these things. But when you realize it's the same author writing all of it, then this is all the point. I always joke, like, it shouldn't surprise anyone when Harry Potter comes back to life. If you don't know that, I'm sorry. You've had like 15 years to figure this out, so this is really not on me. But like at the end, it shouldn't be a surprise that J.K. Rowling, man, look at that, the whole thing lined up for this guy to come back. Well, yeah, because she wrote it. She planned it. Right? So as you get to these scriptures, you see these things that share these similarities. It's because the same author wrote it. Yeah. You do get the idea that kings and nations will come from Abraham's seed. You set primarily probably more with Ishmael. I think in Deuteronomy, they're told, you're going to ask for a king, and God will give you a king, but here are the stipulations. I don't know if they understood the Messiah and the king as the same person, But I also argue that I don't know if they understood the need for the Messiah really until they go into exile. Because it's really when they don't have the land that they keep thinking, when do we get this land back? Right? Like we've stopped worshiping idols, we stopped doing these things, we got to defeat Rome. Oh yeah, there's supposed to be a son of David on the throne forever. When's he going to show up? And I think that's probably when you really begin to see the theology of the kingship and the Messiah really become more prominent. Even though we, having the full revelation, could look back and see it, I think for them, looking more, I think post or during exile and post exile, probably looked, that's when the kingship really got tied to the Messiah in their brains, I would say. Yeah. But the promise of David was always there. You're going to have a line on the throne. And they did until they didn't. Right, I mean, the idea of needing the Messiah didn't necessarily jive the same way because they had kingship. They were autonomous. They had their own rule. So, yeah, good question. All right, so we're gonna stop evaluating her song there. We could spend all night on that. There's a lot of great stuff there, but you get the idea of what's happening here. We're gonna move on to look at Eli and his sons of Belial, right? So in 2:11 through 36, we're going to begin to work through this. At the end of Hannah's song, we get this verse in 11. It says, then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli, the priest. So everything that follows in chapter 2 is meant to create this contrast between Samuel and the house of Eli. Samuel's ministering, and you're going to find out that the sons are just ministering to themselves. Samuel ministers to the Lord, the sons minister to themselves. That's going to be kind of the contrast you see here. And I think you'll see some piety between Elkanah and Eli there as well. So let's look at 1 Samuel 2, 12 through 14. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. That's sons of Belial, right? They did not know the Lord. The custom of the priest, it's never good when your priests do not know the Lord. Right off the bat, you're like, this can't be good, right? This is not good. The custom of the priests with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. All right, so worthless men, sons of Belial. Remember when Hannah's praying and she's not speaking out loud, he comes up and rebukes her and she says, no, I'm not a daughter of Belial. Like, I'm not a worthless woman. So the spin here happening, right? These worthless sons don't know Yahweh, yet served in his courts. And look, listen, when sacrifices would come in, the Levites didn't have an inheritance, right? They didn't have a land inheritance, a portion inheritance. Their inheritance was what the people would bring for sacrifices. So the process was they would pull the breast or something from whatever the animal was, and that was their portion, right? And they, you know, the idea is they'd stick a fork or something, they'd pull something out. And I think there's a sense of you're trusting in God's dependence, right? It's like a, you know, we do this to the house. You got a crock pot meal? Nope. I want the meat, right? Like, it's a carrot, you know? So there is a sense of you stick it in and you pull it out. And the Lord's provision is the Lord's provision, right? Now, think through this. You've got, at this point, probably well over, I mean, like, we know like 600,000-ish people came into Canaan in the conquest. You're a generation or so beyond this. I mean, the way they had kids back then, you're probably looking at well over 1 million people, right? This is the central sanctuary. Lots of sacrifices happening a lot of the time. The priest probably ate pretty good, right? And the priest probably ate pretty good. So this idea of taking, I think the three-pronged fork is meant to point out, like they're trying to grab the extra. This idea, they're just over the gorging that they're doing on the people. And we get this from Leviticus 7, 28, this instruction, 28 through 35, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, whoever offers a sacrifice of his peace offering to the Lord shall bring the offering to the Lord, from the sacrifice of his peace offerings. His own hand shall bring the Lord's food offerings. He shall bring the fat with the breast, right? So keep it all together, that the breast may be waved as a wave offering before the Lord. The priest shall burn the fat on the altar, but the breast shall be for Aaron and his sons. And the right thigh you shall give to the priest as a contribution from the sacrifice of your priest offerings. Whoever among the sons of Aaron offers the blood of a peace offerings and the fat shall have the right thigh for a portion. For the beast that was waved and the thigh that is contributed I've taken from the people of Israel out of the sacrifices of their peace offerings, have given them to Aaron and the priests and his sons as a perpetual due from the people of Israel. This portion of Aaron and of his sons from the Lord's food offering from the day they were presented, this is the portion, the day they were presented to serve as priests for the Lord. So the Lord has this in place to provide for them, and Eli would stick in, sons of Eli, and take much more than they should. And you get the idea that they're not just aiming for whatever, they're aiming for the choicest portions. Look in 15. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servants would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw. Now, the idea is that they want the meat with the fat before the fat gets burned up or cooked off, right? They want the good meat. They want the good cut of what's happening. And who does the fat belong to? The Lord. Right, it's the best of the portion, right? So this idea, so what you have the priests doing, what Phinehas and Hophni are doing, are coming in and they're taking, not only are they taking what the Lord has allocated from his portion as a gift to them, but they're also taking the Lord's portion as well, right? So you see this, just it's complete defilement of what's going on. And this would be a good time for me to announce that I would like a private jet for traveling. I think we can make that work. Do a capital campaign. But you can see this. Like, you can see how the sacrifices of the people are taken by the priests, by corrupt pastors, by people who take more than their share. It could be used for the Lord's work, right? So this idea of what we do with our, we should be good stewards both as pastors, as for them priests, and as people. Holding accountable. And look, some people do. Not everyone lost sight of the proper system. Some would push back, 16 and 17. And if a man said to him, let them burn the fat first, then take as much as you wish, he would say, no, you must give it now, and if not, I'll take it by force. They were thugs, right? Thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. So first use of the word sin in the book of Samuel, and it shows up in the house of Eli to condemn the high priest and his sons. Now, there's another story in the Bible of two sons of a high priest who do this stuff the wrong way. Anyone remember who those guys were? Yeah, Nadab and Abihu, right? Aaron and his sons. Now we have Eli and his sons. Unless we think the pattern dies there, Samuel's sons, they're not very good either, right? So there is something. Judah doesn't stand a chance. Just kidding. Yeah, the ironic line, Aaron's line is just not looking great. Like at some point, Israel's going to have to figure something else out. Like this human high priest thing just doesn't work. Doesn't work. No matter who, even Aaron himself can't keep his sons in check. Eli can't keep his sons in check. Samuel can't keep his sons in check. What hope do they have? Well, I think if you were a fan of the author of Hebrews, he has an answer for you. Melchizedek, priest of a different line. This fallen Aaronic line is never going to be enough. Sinful men, right? You need something different. Let's keep going. 18 through 21. Samuel's ministering before the Lord. A boy, now we're back to Samuel. We have seen their ugliness. We're back to Samuel now. A boy clothed with a linen ephod or ephod, however you want to say it. And his mother used to make for him a little robe and take them each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, may the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she's asked of the Lord. And then they would return to their home. Indeed, the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters. And the boy Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. So again, Samuel, not Eli, not Hophni, not Phinehas, Samuel is ministering before the Lord. And he's wearing an I'll say ephod. I've always said, he's wearing an ephod, which is kind of like an apron type thing, maybe a vest type thing that go over his robes. But look at the contrast. You have this family of Eli, and then you have the family of Samuel, the father traveling in town, the mother making the robes, coming in, making sure he's equipped for what he needs to do, praying for the Lord, and going back, bringing their sacrifice, doing everything right, and Eli's household is doing everything wrong. Let's talk about this ephod for a second. So this is not the same one like the high priest would have worn. The high priest had one with all the jewels, represented the tribes of Israel. Most Levites wore an ephod, priests. They all wore a priest. It was simply this vest, like I said, or apron thing. But it wasn't something a Levite wore until the age of 30, until he was in his priestly service. Right? That's the age they went into priestly service. So it says something incredibly unique about Samuel, that Samuel was wearing one as a young boy. And it probably has something to do with his Nazarite vow, that he's fully for life committed to service of the Lord, whereas the Levites would go in at a certain age and they would roll off at a certain age. And then Hannah gets this great blessing, right? She's faithful to what she says. They come back year after year. And of course, now think about this. Hannah is probably, it said, you know, maybe 5 years, maybe Sam was 5 years, 6 years, I don't know. He's at least four, because when they wean him and she brought him, so he's at least 4 years, probably more. No kids, still no kids, the only child given up. And then finally, after another handful of years, she's blessed with more children, right? The faithfulness to continue to worship, not feel gypped, like not feel like I made this agreement with God and I can't believe he actually took me up on it, right? Like now I lost my, but she is faithful, she understands. And she comes back and continues to serve and ministers to him as he ministers to the Lord, and the Lord blesses her. Right? And then we get this great line, Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. It's going to intensify that in a minute. Back to Eli and his family. So Samuel's growing, things are great. Back to Eli. Here we go. 22 through 26. Now Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all these people. I love it. You had to hear of it from them. You're at the temple with them, my friend. Right? No accountability from the father there. Okay. I don't have a lot of sympathy for Eli, if you can tell. No, my sons, it's no good report that I hear from the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. He's quoting a proverb there. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. And let me read this. We'll come back to that. Yeah, so this it's a great passage, right? It speaks to the role of parents, even in their adult children. I think the idea that your child's 18, 25, 35, 55, and thus you have no say into how they're living their life is absurd. Their calling is to honor you, right? Doesn't mean obey you and everything, but to honor you, which means hear you out. So you speak into their life. That's your calling. Speaking into life, continue to speak into their lives, even as adults. Eli was in a unique position. He had the ability not only to speak into their lives, but he could have done something about it. Eli had all the authority as the high priest to remove his sons from the priesthood. Could he yank them out? He wouldn't do it. It was his duty to yank them out, and he wouldn't do it. How many family businesses come to ruin because they pass it to the son, and they won't take it away when it begins to fall apart? I've seen a lot of that. I've seen a lot of people who build this, spend their years building this company, try to train their son into it, pass it off to him, and the family business begins tanking. And before they step in, it's just too far gone, right? It's tough, right? I understand that. But, you know, there's a great irony, I think, with Eli, too. He's hearing it from everyone else. He's not claiming to see it with his own eyes. He refuses to pull them out. And yet he comes across as very concerned for their souls, which maybe he is, right? Something about Eli we'll get to in a minute tells me that his soul is not in a great place, but he's concerned about their souls, right? If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him, but if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? what is Eli's job for Israel? What's one of them? To intercede, right? I mean, there is a sense of, he quotes this proverb about man sitting as man, and the next part's not a proverb, and he just says, I mean, what can anybody do? Oh, you can get your booty on in there. But Eli knows. I mean, at some point, if you know you're letting this happen, how do you dare walk in the Holy of Holies and ask God to forgive? It's your fault. Remove them. Right? He's not taking his authority. He's not stepping into the role that he's been called to fulfill. And it's worth knowing this sleeping with other women at the tent of meeting. This was a pagan ritual. Do you remember in the fall, we're talking about they sell Joseph into slavery, and then Judah leaves and then stops at a prostitute along the way. And is that was Tamar? I think it's who it is, Tamar, you know, setting him up. And he comes back and he's like, hey, where's the prostitute? That was a cult religious thing. Like, he was doing, like, cult religious worship kind of thing in the area. They would have these prostitutes out there. And so what the sons are doing is they're bringing this pagan concept of sex prostitution into the temple work. So they're not just loose dudes, right? They're also people who were bringing pagan elements into the worship of God, right? So, and again, Eli is sitting back. It's a problem. And these women probably would have been, talk about this with Jephthah. I believe that his daughter was committed to the temple. But it would have been women like that, in a sense, much like Samuel, whose lives were committed to serving in the temple from one way or another. Of course, she obviously would not have, intercourse not part of the gig, like it was a certain, but this is what they had abused and turned this into. And the warning from Eli is that, hey, this is going to incite God's wrath. This is going to be bad on you. He's not going to take this easy. It's going to be bad. You need to turn from your ways, even though I'm not willing to step in and take the action that needs to be taken. And then look at 26. Look how Samuel's described. Now the boy Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord and also with man. Who does that sound like? Jesus, right? Luke 2:52. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and favor with God and man. Right, so we're given stark contrasts. What's Jesus going to accuse the Pharisees of being? Whitewashed tombs? Yeah, hypocrites. You're getting what is seen as a royal aristocracy, Eli and his sons, compared to Samuel, who's faithfully serving. The same line to Jesus, who's going to begin to call out the aristocracy of Israel for their abominations. And it's funny, they don't, you know, after the exile, outward idolatry goes away from Israel. Like, they finally get it. They get expelled, they come back in the lands, and you never see them building the Asherah or building in the high places. This all goes away. But what happens is their works-based mentality just can't get out of their head. And so it becomes righteous works, right? More, their idol becomes their works. That's how the 600 whatever laws of the Pharisees, right? Their idolatry becomes an inward, less obvious idolatry, and how many knots you can tie, how many steps you can walk, how you can, and how dare these people not be doing the same thing, right? This kind of becomes the thing. So you see Samuel's dealing with this. Jesus will deal with this. And in this verse and in Luke, it's a transition, right? So in Luke, it's a transition between Jesus' childhood and his ministry. He's growing in wisdom, stature. Then we get into his ministry. For Samuel, it's a similar thing. He's been learning and growing, ministering to the Lord. Well, his calling is going to happen the next time we begin to talk with Samuel. So Samuel's going to look a lot like Moses. He's going to look a lot like Jesus. He's going to look a lot like John the Baptist, because he's going to combine all of these offices in a really unique way that the other prophets don't, the other priests don't, and no other king really does. David gets close, but in a way that Christ will. So a lot of typology, a lot of continuity happening here. Any thoughts or questions at this point? We've got just a handful more to get through. All right. So let's read 27 through 29. And there came a man of God to Eli and said to him, thus says the Lord, did I indeed reveal myself to the house of your father? when they were in Egypt, subject to the house of Pharaoh? Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? I gave to the house of your father all my offerings by fire from the people of Israel. Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded for my dwelling, and honor your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel? It's interesting. I can only think of one other place where someone's, or maybe two other places, the man of God comes up. So 1 Samuel 9, there will be a man of God. Saul will just say, someone send me a man of God. I'm trying to figure something out. So Saul asks for a man of God. We get this, we have this one here in 2. Then in 1 Kings, Jeroboam is going on his way, and a man of God approaches him and offers him the kingdom. You're faithful to God, we'll let your line reign for a long time. Ultimately, it's got to go back to Judah, back to David. But if you're faithful, I'll give you a long, good run of line with it. Jeroboam, of course, turns against, builds golden calves in places. And then in Judges 6:8, a man of God is sent to Israel as a prophet. So probably that's just that era when they're writing, like that time in history, how they refer to a prophet. It's a man of God, right? It's a prophet, but it's kind of mysterious. You know, we get most prophets by name, but now this man of God shows up. And it's interesting, it's really a condemnation on Eli beyond just the message. The message is bad, right? The message is a condemnation, right? Why does God need to call a prophet to go talk to the high priest? It's a problem. It's a problem. Like, if God cannot talk to his high priest, we have a problem. So it's condemnation on Eli. He's got to send somebody else because Eli can't hear it. His sin, his abdication of his role have put a wedge between him and God. So the lines of communication are broken down. Eli's hard heart has disqualified him from serving and hearing God's voice. Let's keep going, 30 through 34. Therefore, the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promise that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me. For those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. Then in distress you will look with envious eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed on Israel, and there shall not be an old man in your house forever. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from the altar shall be spared to weep his eyes out and to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your household shall die by the sword of men. And this shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. This shall be a sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. All right, so not great. Eli's had better days. Lord's done with him. And there's a question, how can God make an eternal covenant that stops being eternal? That's what he said. I made a covenant would go on forever, but I'm not going to do it. What do we do with that? I think the Hebrew helps us out a little bit here. The word in Hebrew that we have in forever, let me pull it back up here. Verse 30, I promise your house and your house your father in and out before me forever. The word there, it can mean eternally, but often means something more like perpetually. So Yahweh promises that Eli's forefather in Numbers 14, because of his zeal, the high priestly line, he was one of Aaron's sons, but he says the high priestly line will come from this line now. All of them will come through this, right? You'll go in and out from my presence. This is where it will be perpetually. Now, something that's perpetual can be eternal, or it can simply be perpetual until it stopped, right? Legally, we have things called perpetual contracts, right? You just set it up. There's no end date. Continues, but there are conditions to which you can shut it down, terminate it. So I think it's a good time to talk a little bit about God's covenants, and we're going to get tight, I think, on time in the next 5-6 minutes here. We may come back to this next week. So covenants can be violated. We know that, right? A marriage is a covenant. It can be violated. right? We can violate a covenant. The offended party then has an option. They can choose to forgive the violation and re-enter into covenant, or they can choose to say, you've broken the covenant, I'm out, right? And so we understand that relationship. We have a relationship in all kinds of different things. And I think, and I want to kind of hedge this, because I want to say this the right way, and I don't want to make myself an internet meme by saying it, right? But you can make an argument that there are only two covenants that are truly eternal. Okay, so the first is the covenant of works. This is Adam and God, the covenant between them, covenant of works, right? You do this, you live, you eat the fruit, you die. These are the options. And as Adam is our federal head, we all fall with him. Now, after Adam, there's no more federal head for all of humanity, right? You have covenants to Abraham, but there's no federal head for all of humanity. So covenant works has this eternal aspect as long as the earth exists, right? Then you can argue that the next is the covenant of grace. Now, the covenant of grace, we see, of course, you see it back in 3:15, right? You see it, but where we typically go to the initial covenant of grace, we tend to go to Genesis 15. And you remember, Genesis 15 is where God makes his covenant with Abram. And he comes in, and he remember, Abraham cuts all the animals up and separates them, right? And then God puts him to sleep, and then Yahweh walks through, and then he walks through again. So what's he doing? He's walking through once for him, and then the other time for who? For Abraham, right? The only way that covenant can be forever is if it will never be broken. And so God walks his side of it, and he says the only way that this isn't violated is if I'm the one on the other side of it. And so he walks man's side of it. And so you have an eternal covenant, one that can never be broken, made in that moment. And all through the Bible, you have covenants that are that end, covenants that are broken. They can be violated. We see it with Saul, right? I made my covenant, my chesed with you as a king, but you violated the terms. Like you, and God can choose to overlook the covenant infidelity. That's the whole point of Hosea. The whole point of Hosea is that he overlooks the breaking of the covenant over and over and over and over and over. But he doesn't have to. And so when you get to this situation here with the son, the high priest, the condition is you don't despise me. The high priest had regulations, rules they lived by, things they do. When Eli, God won't speak to Eli, but he's going to speak to Samuel, and Eli will recognize the Lord is speaking, and I can't even hear it. Just answer him, Samuel. Right? Eli knows it. He's so cut off, he's so calloused, he's not a high priest. He's just a guy with the title sitting in the temple, but he's failed. He's lost it. He's disqualified himself. In the same way that Moses can disqualify himself from going in the promised land, Eli can disqualify himself from being a high priest of the Lord. He can do it. And God doesn't have to redeem him to it. Doesn't have to, because the covenant's been violated. So I think it's an important piece for us to understand as we understand covenants and covenantal structure. Every covenant might be perpetual. It doesn't mean every covenant is eternal. It can be perpetual until someone, our marriage is perpetual unless one of us violate the covenant. And then you have an opportunity to say, I'm out, or I forgive and we re-enter this covenant again. So it's an important piece just to be thinking through. And I don't know if I put, oh, I did. Okay. So, He tells Eli, the covenant's over. You violated it. It's done, right? And look, I think it's a great irony. The reason, I cannot think of his name. I think it was Phinehas. I think Phinehas was the high priest's son who, out of zeal for the Lord, goes and does what has to be done. I think it goes and kills some people who are doing some bad stuff. Goes and strikes them down. What is Eli's problem? He has no zeal for the Lord. It's a great irony. The guy who brings it into the line is all about zeal. That's why you're the high priest. Eli has no zeal. No zeal for holiness. No zeal for God's things. And so he loses it. with that. Any questions on that? I know it's kind of a weird thing to hear. Okay. Let's read these last two verses. 35 and 36. Says they're going to die on the same day. That's how you're going to know this is coming true, right? 35. And I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. I will build him a sure house. He shall go in and out before my anointed forever. And everyone who's left in your house shall come to implore him for a piece of silver, a loaf of bread, and shall say, please put me in one of the priest's places that I may eat a morsel of bread. And the question becomes, what's he talking about? Is he talking about Samuel? We already know Samuel's sons are a problem, right? We know that's not good. So is it Samuel? Is it Christ? Another order, huh? Is it David? Does David go in and out before the anointed forever? Depends on how you understand death and maybe. I mean, I'm not saying no. I think those are good answers. I think you can make the argument the ultimate fulfillment is Christ, right? But Christ is also the anointed. So going in, but he's also the high priest. He's the prophet. He's king, right? But you get this idea that what we have, what exists, just doesn't cut it. And I continue to go back to this Melchizedek kind of mindset. There's got to be something better because it just, every plan with humanity just continues to fall apart. Now, I think I might have brought this up last week. If you ever think that if you could control everything, you'd fix everything, just remember Noah had everyone on the earth wiped out and couldn't figure it out, right? I mean, we are just that fallen. This is who we are. And so we need something better. And Hebrews just picks up on that theme so much. The order of Melchizedek, the better high priest, the better king, all of those things is Christ. And so part of what we go through, as we work through Samuel, we're going to see times that Samuel's great. We're going to see times where Samuel fails. We're going to see times where kings are great. We're going to see times where kings fail. And we're going to see times when prophets are wrong, but they're not necessarily wrong, right? You want to build the temple? Go ahead, build the temple. God says, Nathan, go back and tell him not to build the temple. God said, don't build the temple, right? Like, I mean, sometimes you can be wrong without being sinful, right? And so we're going to see all these things as we work through these First and Second Samuel, and then getting the kings and the fall and all that kind of good stuff. So.